Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
It's another Saturday. I am Josh Hadley, and we have the whole crew with us this week. Joining us for the first time this week, well, not the first time on this show, but the first time as a regular cast member, we have the Kid.
Swag. Am I going to get kicked off for that?
No.
Okay, Swag.
But then there is Glenn Criddle coming to us from the UK.
Again, hello.
Short to the point. And then, of course, and my phone going off in the background, but fuck you, I'm not answering you. And then we also have Sarah Hanley, not Hadley, Hanley, it's spelled and pronounced differently.
So that would make me the anti-swag?
If you want to.
Because okay. Josh is just complete swag.
Bitches. Now, I would ask one of you to do the Adam and Eve promo, but I can't. The Adam and Eve promo has changed. Some fucker leaving a message, fine. The Adam and Eve promo has changed. Now, if you use the promo code STATIC at adamandeve.com, you don't get what you used to before. You get 10 free gifts. 10! You get 6 free DVDs. You get free U.S. shipping. Sorry, Glenn and Dustin. Sarah, you can get free U.S. shipping.
Yay!
You get a special toy for him, a special toy for her, and a free mystery gift that, according to what I'm supposed to be reading, quote, you will both enjoy. So 10 free items on top of whatever butt toy you end up buying at adamandeve.com, all for using the promo code STATIC. How can you go wrong with that?
There's probably a few ways, though, but I don't think with that deal you can go wrong with the deal itself.
They are also absolved from the ER visit that may result in having something removed from you.
Exactly. So that's your fault, not theirs.
Well, and then there is also going to drivethroughrpg.com. You can get the Systemless Settings Bundle from Al Seeger. It's, you know, if you don't want to play Star Trek with the Star Trek rules or D&D with the D&D rules, which who the hell would, you go to drivethroughrpg.com and get the Systemless Settings Bundle. I usually have trouble saying that, so yay. Tonight we're going to talk the tired tropes of movies and TV. I guess you could call them cliches, or you could call them the just lazy writing that we constantly fall back on. The one that I hate the most is love triangles. He loves her. She doesn't know he exists. She's dating a total douchebag who everyone can see is a total douchebag. To me, the love triangle is the ultimate lazy trope. That this is something that you go to when you have nothing else. I have seen TV shows I've been loving, and then as soon as the love triangle gets introduced, I go, fuck it. You know what? Screw you. If you're not going to try, then neither am I. I'm done. I hate the love triangle. What do you think, Sarah?
Oh, it's just shows we don't want to actually write anything for half of each episode for, I don't know, like, 2 seasons. Even when they did it on shows that involved Superman, you're still like, don't, please, no, oh, good. She's in love with one and she isn't in love with the other and they're the same one because that's so clever. No.
What do you think, Glenn, coming at this from a Brit perspective?
Yeah, I've always found that the love triangle tends to be the, shall we say, the holding card for any series, whether it's usually sitcoms. I find it in. It's always this thing that they seem to put in there just because, well, it fills out the space. It's padding. And it's just really, really lazy. And it does bug me. And it's rarely done well either.
What about a Canadian perspective?
Well, I think the whole love interest thing in general is way just overdone. Like, just in general, like the whole, oh, we have to have a love interest. We have to introduce a love interest. And that's been introduced.
That's the reason the woman is there, to be a love interest for our hero.
Yes, but why can't it just be like, you know, Mulder and Scully, where it's just like, yo, you're my partner. We're partners and stuff. And we're doing this together. And, you know, But no, it always has to be like love interest. And but then going into like the love triangle, it's a very, very lazy trope that's overused, and it's like hack writing 101 pretty much. It's like, oh, how do I cause like a dilemma? Well, let's introduce the love triangle, and you know, it ugh.
Well, and it
never,
going off
never offers anything new, does it?
No. And that's a lot of things with just like media as it is keep within, and I'm sure we're going to be covering like a lot of these, like keep within the cliches and like the tropes and everything, because that's what people expect and what they're used to and what they're comfortable with. When there's,
how dare you give people something outside of the norm, right?
Exactly. How dare you make them think, you know, back in the day when it was these things were first coming like into the media, in certain medias, be it like books, TV, movies, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, I could see like people being like, yeah, wow, I, you know, that was interesting that. But now it's just, you know, it's like shut off your brain and go with it. You know, it's like Twilight. You know? They didn't like, okay, as bad as those books and movies are, overall, the love triangle thing is, can I swear?
Fuck you.
Fucking useless. From the beginning of that series to the end, the whole love triangle thing and this big hype that came with it and everything was pointless. It was useless. There was no real thing behind it except for its really lazy trope. Like, there was no actual purpose behind it. And you just see that in, like, rom-coms. You have, like so many movies that are just that are just love triangles, and
it's a very woman thing. Sarah?
Yeah, for one thing I want to object. You use the word like and Twilight next to each other. I can't have that. And for these to go on as long as they fucking do, you have to have the person who likes the girl, because it's always the guy who likes the girl who sees that the guy is no good for her, and yet he holds back. He doesn't say anything. These could be resolved in 15 minutes if people were honest.
If people were realistic.
Yes, if you don't have these things written by writers who... I love writers, I know many writers, but the people who write this have to be the people who are sitting at the cafe at the same table every day, because they know that a cute girl goes there. Uh-huh. And they're like, I wish I had the balls to talk to her, but I'm going to hope that she notices me instead.
Yeah, it's just so stock, isn't it? It's just like the storylines are taken straight off the shelf, and you know, it's kind of this prefabricated situation which they can just recycle time and time and time again, and it never feels fresh, and it never really goes anywhere. It is just a way of filling out the runtime, and that's sad when a series gets to that sort of state.
But to a degree, and I'm not making an excuse in the least, and Sarah, this is not a sexist comment, generally women like the love triangle, because generally it's the woman who's involved in the love triangle in real life. Most like the speculative fiction, my wife reads a lot of it, not Twilight, but a lot of like the witch series and all this kind of stuff of novels. They all involve love triangles. Twilight's about a love triangle. Women seem to really get into this, which I guess that's why they keep going back to this. They want the female audience, and to do that, he loves her, but she doesn't know he exists. Ooh, I'm all a Twitter.
Well, partially that's because it shows it from his perspective. And when you show it from his perspective, he is expressing his feelings, if only to himself. And you have these, yeah. And you have these women who are like, I wish I had a guy who would show his love to me. And though I am not going to actually find someone who's worthy of me, I'm going to instead read about this person who's fictional and can't hurt me.
Well, and looks like a young Hugh Grant or Matthew McConaughey.
They always do. They never look like Gerard Depardieu, you know?
They never look like Josh Hadley.
No shit. Who's kind of a fatter Rob Zombie, really.
Yeah, exactly. They should make that movie.
We should have Mountain Man romance novels.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are somewhere. I haven't looked.
Oh, God, there are. I'm sure.
Oh, with the whole hype of, like, beards and stuff going on right now and girls swooning over beards and stuff on the internet and on Tumblr and stuff, I wouldn't be surprised.
And this is coming from the guy that looks like an old lesbian.
I can't argue.
Well,
I have my days.
You know what they say. I mean, before it was knee socks, now it's beards. Tomorrow it's going to be knee socks and beards.
Yeah, you're not going to catch me in knee socks. But then there is a bastard child of the love triangle, and that is something Dustin hinted at earlier, like with Mulder and Scully. Will they, won't they? The male and female that are just partners, and there's a little bit of a playful spark, which real people have. You ever worked with somebody in any kind of environment for an extended time, you get a playful spark, whether it's actually sexual or not. I think the will they, won't they is the bastard child of the love triangle, and I think that is even more of a more disgusting than the love triangle, because that kind of says everybody is sexually attracted to everybody, and men and women cannot simply work together without some sort of weird sexual attraction. Since you brought it up, Dustin, even if you didn't intend to, your thoughts?
Like I said before, I hate it. I don't like it. You know, like, you know, in Aliens, like, if there was a forced romance between, like, Ripley and Hicks, which there's probably slash fic out there.
The closest that got was playful.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, like, joking around and that kind of stuff. But and then you look at, like, Alien 4, where I forget if she's all, like, friendly with Ron Perlman in that one. I can't remember.
She fucks an alien in that one, though.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. There you go. Ron Perlman's close enough to an alien.
I wish I could.
He was a beast.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, no, just like forced romances, and I don't need it, you know? You know, some of my favorite movies avoid, like, forced romances and stuff. You don't see any forced romances in John Carpenter's The Thing.
Well, that's a relief.
or even unless they live. Like that makes fun of, like, it insinuates it, but then it just, like, throws it completely away, and, you know, just that whole trope is just, I don't think it's needed, and I think it's like a safety net of just like, oh, look, you should like this character because it's a love interested to this character that you're already invested in, and it's like
it's an archetype.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very weak arc that, you know, a 4-year-old could write.
Yeah, it's cheap, isn't it? At the end,
it's
of the day.
Really cheap. Yeah,
and you know, that's the thing. It's kind of, again, it's one of those things that they just throw in there to pad out the series and to give you something to keep watching for. Although, you know, I mean, it's just done again and again and again. And if it's in small amounts, you can get away with it. But it's when a series particularly decides that it's going to hang so much of its runtime on that. You know, there's so much binging. Yeah, Friends. Another good example. You know, that was like 10 seasons of it. And just, it's absolutely bloody ridiculous when it gets to that sort of length. It's like, kind of, you know, just have done with it.
Fucking get it over with.
Move on. Yeah.
Yeah. It took so many seasons, and then it took them having a kid together, and then, like, all this stuff. And, like, oh, God.
Yeah.
How about a female perspective on this one?
Well, I was going to say that it can be done not horribly. The way that they really seem to like to fuck it up is that you have outside characters that are only introduced for one episode, and they start to get close to either the male or the female, and then the other one gets really jealous, and the one who's being hit on is completely oblivious to it and doesn't understand.
It becomes a love triangle.
Yes, but only for that one episode, just to show they could be a couple, but they don't know it. And even the one who's jealous doesn't realize that they actually wants to be with them because, you know, we need another half a season.
Right. Well, then another one that always bugs me, and this one I guess I can blame the producers for, but I can't, because this is less of a writer's trope. Obvious traitor is obvious. Like, if you cast Malcolm McDowell as the traitor in your group, you brought up They Live, Meg Foster. Mm-hmm. She's always the villain. Why are you surprised she betrayed you? It's usually obvious traitor is obvious. That's less of a writing trope and more of a producing. You cast a good actor, but they're always the villain. Why did you think you'd get a plot twist out of making them the villain?
Well, yeah, it's just like anyone who hires James Wood. It's like, you're going to get James Wood. And what does James Wood always do? He's the villain, like, a majority of the time.
Like, I'm thinking of, like, the movie Moon 44, the Michael Paré movie. Mm-hmm. It was Devlin and Emmerich's first film in, like, 1990 or 89. And throughout the whole movie, they're trying to figure out who the traitor is. The captain of the space station is Malcolm McDowell. It's McDowell. Then when he's revealed to be the traitor, you go, that was so anticlimactic, fuck you.
Like, you could be in the other room as it happened, and you'll be like, yeah, it was him, right?
Oh, gee, McDowell was the traitor. Never saw that coming. or like, oh, gee, Eric Roberts is a psycho killer. Never saw that coming. Sarah?
My question for you is, let's say you have a movie, and you have both Tim Curry and Malcolm McDowell in it. Which one's the traitor?
And Eric Robert. Well, it depends. Yes. Do they betray each other?
That would actually be interesting. We're talking about cliches.
I would say Malcolm McDowell would be the mastermind behind, like, the evil guy who betrays everyone, but Tim Curry would be the guy you're sketchy about, but, you know, he has his own intentions, but he's not, like, super duper evil.
Well, because I'm thinking of, like, the first season of Heroes, where Malcolm McDowell was the big bad for the whole season, and one of his henchmen was Eric Roberts. It's like just casting right into the tropes, aren't you? What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, it can be very obvious when they do that sort of stuff, but occasionally they catch you out because they play it the other way, and that's always an interesting situation. So I can kind of put up with it to some extent, and there's a reason why these guys are cast anyways, because they're just, you know, so damn good at those roles, generally speaking.
Well, and then another tired trope, and this is something that's a little more of a subtle trope. This is something that Christopher Nolan likes to do, and I get a ton of crap for pointing this out, but he does it. This is something where you need to make your hero seem much more competent, because you can't surround him with a competent crew, otherwise then the hero doesn't look as good, right? Look at, like, The Dark Knight. It requires... What's that?
Do I have to?
Yes. That movie requires Gotham PD to be the most incompetent police force in America for Batman to seem cool. They fall for every one of the Joker's traps. Even after they know it's a trap, Batman's the only one that sees it coming. You know, the Joker is trying to kill Gordon. So, hey, let's have his honor guard be these four guys we've never seen before, who one of them suspiciously has facial scars that look like the Joker. Nah, nothing's weird for that. Hey, this guy's chest is ringing like a cell phone. Let's all gather around to listen to this, even though the Joker's pulled a dozen traps on us before, usually with explosives. Oh, the Joker faked us out again? Oh, no. You have to make everyone around the hero incompetent to make them look good. I cannot stand that trope. That is insulting to the audience, I believe. Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is obviously that they have a certain amount of runtime, so it's very difficult, I think, to necessarily be at nuance that you can actually get away with making everybody sort of normal. And I think, I don't know, something like Batman, sometimes that's kind of just one of the pitfalls you're likely to fall into. I mean, certainly with, like, you know, right back to the classic series there, it was always the same situation. So I don't think it's anything particularly new that Christopher Nolan's doing. But yeah, it could be a bit tiresome. I can kind of see why it sort of happens. It's just forcing the situation and moving things along a bit faster.
Sarah?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Glenn, but I'm just going to have to say it's a crap writer, because if you can only write your hero as awesome by making everyone else a dunderhead, then it looks like either they're taking a day trip through the short wing of the hospital, or you're surrounded by incompetents who shouldn't even be given squirt guns. You'd see that all the way back to classic literature, where you have Sherlock Holmes, and if you have takes of Sherlock Holmes done on the screen where either you have his everyone around him being absolute idiots, and you have Watson just going, oh my God, he is so amazing, I'm going to write about this. Or if you have a better writer, then you have Holmes noticing things, and because you have the support of a guy who used to be a wartime doctor supporting him, you know, able to put these things together and actually solve the damn cases, then you have an interesting story. So I'm going to say crap writer.
That's fair enough. I think it's kind of one of those things that, obviously, a lot of films have had this kind of issue, with this particular example. I think is it just crap writing? Yeah, possibly. Maybe they could have done it a bit smarter. But I think it's as much a matter of focus as it is anything else, I think. And of course, with Batman has to be the central character, just like in something like the Robin Hood film, the Kevin Costner one, they sort of had to tone down the villain, Alan Rickman's part, to shift the focus back to who the movie is supposed to be about. And I think that's part of the reason why this kind of happens. Is it crap writing? To an extent, yes. But sometimes it's just kind of how these things pan out.
Dustin?
I kind of got to agree with both, because I see where Glenn's coming from, and there is examples where that works, you know, and where it makes sense and everything. But also with what Sarah said, it's just very, very lazy, and it's very it's kind of insulting to the audience in some cases, because you're basically saying, well, these people, they're not smart, and they have this very smart protagonist or person in the forefront and everything.
Oh no.
That and like it's a derived way to explain things in a film, I find. And I've seen that a lot where writers have used that as
a crutch?
Yeah, basically to explain certain things, you know, where it's just like, oh, well, what's this? Like the supporting characters will question it and everything, because they don't have that knowledge. But then, you know, the main protagonist or whoever, they'll spew this exposition and explain all of it. And just so like the audience is like, oh, I get it now. And sometimes it's too much, and it's like, it feels like it's talking down to an audience. So I get what Glenn is saying, though. To an extent, it can work.
Now, there was the complete overuse of that in, I forget which branch of Law and Order it was, but you had the one guy who knew everything as soon as that was needed in that episode. Oh, look, that's in Swahili. I understand that. Oh, look, they're using Morse code. I know that. And I don't know about you, but I couldn't take more than half a season of just every single episode him having that particular key you needed for that particular mystery. And then,
it's never brought up again after
yes.
that. Yeah, that's another big trope that usually you can tell when they're going to do this, where all of a sudden at the beginning of the episode, the character mentions how they used to have to, their mother made them take piano lessons. It's never been brought up before. And then him knowing the piano keys ends up solving the case, and it's never brought up again. The way that that is not tired is if you introduce that trait slowly over time, like you introduce that 5 episodes prior to when it's going to be needed, I don't consider that so lazy. But the way they usually do it is you get the special skill introduced in the episode where the special skill comes in. That's just lazy. We don't want to deal with continuity. We don't expect you to have remembered what happened 5 weeks ago, right? That's just lazy.
Well, I think kind of an example of that, I don't know why this came to mind, but I think it might be an example of what we're talking about is like when you look at like the Hannibal series and like Will Graham and that.
Well, I think that falls into the obvious traitor is obvious. My wife watches Hannibal.
Well, I'm talking the books
also. None of these
also.
Characters. Hannibal acts like a fucking serial killer. How was Will Graham the only one that was able to see he's a fucking serial killer?
Well, I'm talking also the books also. Because you know, you have Will who has this specific set of skills, and that's sort of his character, is he has these skills that are beyond the others around them. But then also you have this team of people who are also doing their job and able to help him out. And, you know, they have their own set of skills that are able to, you know, aid him when he needs it. So that's basically kind of like what Glenn was saying, is something like that, where it's sort of like... It's like having competent side characters and supporting characters, not just like dumbed down to heighten your protagonist.
Yeah, and I think Star Trek was really bad, particularly Voyager was particularly bad for doing all that kind of stuff where characters would suddenly manifest these skills that they never ever had before. You know, Chakotay was suddenly be into paleontology for his whole life. Never heard anything about it, you know, 3 or 4 seasons. And then the next week he'd have some expertise in medicine of one kind
Seven
or another.
Seven of Nine was the worst in that, how she was an expert at everything because Borg.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
She was very much the multi-tool, wasn't she, in that?
We can't figure out how to write out of this. Seven has some Borg power that does it. Yeah. Seven was a crutch on that show, too.
Yeah, she was Swiss Army penknife, wasn't she, really? And at the end of the day, you know, she was the scissors 1 week, the knife the next, and then that thing that you pick stones out of horses' hooves with them on the following week, depending on what they needed to do. But the whole cast was used like that in, to some extent, one way or another.
Well, I don't know. To be fair, Harry Kim was always equally useless.
No, he was always useless, but what can you do with a flute? Yeah, but Paris in that particularly, you know, he was a medic, a pilot, an engineer. I mean, this guy kind of
the medic
one's shit.
The only one I'll give you, because that was actually set up in the pilot that he had medical training beforehand. Mm-hmm. So that one I don't think was as lazy, because they actually set that one up before it was needed.
I think it was only because it was so early in the series that you can get away with doing that. But, you know, it's just every week it felt like there was some new skill that he had, this thing that he was always been really, really big into for his entire life. And we'd never heard about
The one I loved was how Paris was an expert on 20th century Earth when they found when they found that old 1950s Jeep floating in space.
Yeah.
And he recognized it and knew how to start it and everything because he was an expert on 20th century Earth. Mm-hmm. That never came up before or after.
Oh, no, that did come up. That did come up on quite a few occasions because he was always into the 20th century stuff. That was one of his hobbies, which did sort of carry on. But it was a convenience.
Oh, that's right. He actually replicated an old tube TV at one point, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I forgot about that part. Well, on this same token, how about the incompetent leader that never listens to his second in command, the second in command always being right, and yet somehow the leader who is a constant screw up always seems to get through it, by his second in command. That kind of goes with the Batman thing where, but in this case, it's the opposite. Instead of surrounding yourself with incompetence to make your hero look better, you have to make your superiors look incompetent. Like, you go to any Law and Order. The detectives know what's really going on, but all the politics being played at 1PP, that, you know, that's getting in the way of everything. Oh my God, is that a tired trope, huh?
It's like Zap Brannigan.
Exactly what I was thinking.
Well, I don't know if they all have a love of velour and champagne. I mean, I'll admit, I do love champagne.
But it is an example of that, and I think it's like making fun of that, where you have this guy who's like, I'm great, and I'm the best, and he makes these horrible decisions, and like his second in command's like, you really shouldn't do that.
And he keeps on failing up.
Yes, exactly. And there's so many examples of that in so many things, and it's like... It is becoming more and more of like an overused trope and stuff, because it's more used as like a like, oh, isn't that so quirky how he's such an idiot, but you know, everyone around him, he frustrates them, but he gets the job done because of them, and he looks good because of it. And it's it is really tiring.
I think people sort of identify with it, though. It's the because they sort of see themselves in that, in the lower person's role, as you know, they're propping up their boss, like you kind of sometimes feel like in real life. And I think that's probably why it's used so much, is because it is, it's a warm and fuzzy sort of feeling you get from that kind of thing. You get that sense of superiority.
But it also brings up the question: if this boss is so incompetent, how in the fuck did they get to be the boss?
Sleeping around.
Must have a big dick, all right? Must have a really, really big dick. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that trope used in Josh, your favorite recent movie, Guardians of the Galaxy? I haven't seen it myself, but what they've done with the Star-Lord character, it seems like that's what they've done.
The Star-Lord character I grew up reading has nothing to do with that movie. Yeah, the Star-Lord character I grew up reading was a staunch, square-jawed space cop. Not a rogue pirate that makes snide remarks. Yes, and they're totally the same character. They're totally the same character. Yes, totally.
Well, that's because that trope that you grew up is so tired and old, and Shatner did it to death and everything, and no one wants to see that anymore. Instead, they want to see parodies of Shatner where he's lazy and fat and talks all weird and everything. But Spock gets it done. And actually, I think, the new Star Trek, I would that be an example of that? I don't know. I can't really
kind of go that way.
Yeah, because what's his name who plays Shatner in like the two in the new one?
Chris Pine.
Yeah, I don't really remember Into Darkness all that much, and I don't really want to.
You shouldn't need to.
Yeah, exactly. But the Star Trek and like the 2009 one and everything, he was kind of just like, he was good at other things and everything, but he was looked down upon. He was kind of goofy, kind of running all over the place, and everyone's like, "What are you doing?" And Spock's like, as usual, like Spock's the smart one who's getting stuff done and everything, and they have to go get like.
Let's face it, McCoy's the only reason anyone watches those movies anyway. Is Carl?
Oh
Urban's
yeah, yeah,
amazing. Carl he embodied fucking DeForest Kelly.
Yeah,
and there was a reason he got the best lines.
Well, the reason he got the best lines in the classic Trek series was DeForest Kelly made nice with all the writers, so they gave him all the best lines. You ever wonder why Bones gets all of the best lines in the classic Trek? He schmoozed the writers.
He's a smart guy.
Exactly.
That's wasted.
Now, one of the ones I find the most insulting, and they do this in comic books as much as they do it in movies and TV, is, as you know, and then they go to explain a major info dump. If the character knows all this, then why are you telling it to him again in meticulous detail? Or if you're doing like an interrogation, the character's been interrogated for the last 6 hours, all right, let's go over it one more time. And then that's used as the flashback. Why? I get it. You need to get this information to the audience. but that's one of the laziest possible ways you can do it.
Mm-hmm. It can be much, can it? It's
as soon as I hear "as you know," I go, "Then why are you telling me?" Yeah. I mean, you know, my wife doesn't come up to me and go, "As you know, we need this stuff from the grocery store." Yeah, I know, I have the list. You don't need to, you don't need to go over it again with me. I'm holding it in my hand. So it's just it's lazy, Glenn.
Yeah, I just watched this. I've just got through watching this film for my next review, which is the epitome of everything you just said. It is literally has entire scenes of them explaining the background of explaining what's happening, when it's going to happen, why it's happening, stuff we've already seen, and speaking to the dialogue between the characters is just that kind of, oh yes, yes, as you know, I got this, I'm coming to stay at this hotel, and they go on to explain things to the character who already knows and obviously knows because they're sat there waiting for their next line.
And at that point, just do fucking voiceover.
Yeah, it's absolutely infuriating when it gets that level. Sometimes it sort of happens that you do need to do that sort of stuff. I mean, with, for instance, Inception, there's so much going on. There has to be the exposition because everything's so damn complicated. So there's no better way of getting it over than to do it that way, or at least no more expedient way to get it over than to do it in that kind of fashion. But I mean, even with that was one of the weakest elements of that film, was that sort of stuff going on. And yes, it's incredibly overused. People not thinking about how these things should be kind of communicated. And, you know, as the old saying goes, show, don't tell. If you can do that, so much the better.
Well, I don't know. I do disagree with that. I hear that all the time, the show, don't tell. Sometimes tell can be better. If you've got an actor that can really ramp up the tension, I've seen certain TV shows where you see like a different cut of it. Like, I know I'm about to praise Joss Whedon, which, you know, is blasphemy for me. But like, I've got the original cut of the Firefly pilot. Remember in Firefly's aired pilot, they have a flashback to the Battle of Serenity with Mal and Zoe. In the original pilot, it was Mal and Zoe telling that story. And the way the music was coming up and the way the acting handled it, it was much more effective with them telling the story of the Battle of Serenity than seeing it. Seeing it was just sort of a, okay. Hearing them tell it from like a horrific perspective put you there. And I've seen that in a few other things. Sometimes telling works better.
Well, yeah, like I mean, Star Wars. That's certainly the case when you – sorry. After you.
No, go ahead. Well, I was going to say, well,
yes.
Shut up, Dustin, Glenn.
Excuse me. Yeah, sometimes it's a narrative thing, though, isn't it? Yeah, there is a little bit of a delay. Sometimes it's a narrative thing. Sometimes, yeah, the telling can work better if it's done in a fashion that actually doesn't feel like it's talking to the audience. It's talking to between the two characters. I think when you get the worst kind of exposition dumps and that in that kind of fashion, it always feels like it's breaking the fourth wall. But when you can get the characters to do it in such a fashion that it's them communicating between each other, yeah, sure, it can work.
Now Dustin may speak.
Well, it's just like in the original Star Wars, like A New Hope and everything, when Ben Kenobi's talking about, you know, Anakin and like Luke's father and how they were good friends and, you know, they fought in the Clone Wars and that kind of stuff. Like how he told that story is really effective and everything. And and then you see it and it's like, what the fuck? And like this is brought up in, as a lot of people are probably saying right now, like, or thinking about, like, you know, the Red Letter Meetup Plinkett reviews and that kind of stuff, you know. And he even makes a joke in those reviews, is just like, what's that over there? Is that the script on the set? You know, and sometimes when like it's so expository, like Glenn said, it like breaks the fourth wall and it feels like, you know, you're literally being read like a script. Rather than, you know, figuring some of this stuff out on your own and everything, or, you know, being like being told these things in a way that,
to be fair, no producer ever went broke underestimating the stupidity of this viewing public.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what we're talking about, is basically these tropes that people use over and over again to sell media and, you know, push it out. And audiences are just like, okay, get my ticket. Let's watch it in 3D.
Sarah?
Yeah, I will say that the torture scene where they go over everything is slightly better because they're trying to torture the guy. So maybe he's just been saying this for the last 3 hours until the guy wants to confess or stab himself with something. But when you have the group of people and they're about to rob the bank or steal the microchip and they go, one more time, we're going to go over this. You're like, you're in the middle of enemy territory. You are just about to do something very illegal and you decide to get all in a little huddle circle and tell your story wrong time.
This should have been done before this.
Well, another example that's close to that and everything that you see in a lot of movies is just like if someone is put on assignment or something and, you know, you have the caretaker or something who's just like, as you well know, this this place is, you know, the history of this. And it's like, well, you just pointed out that he already knows, like, like, as you know, this facility does this.
This facility is prepared for this, yes.
Yeah, and it's just like, well, why do you think he was chosen, and why do you think he was there, or that character is there, or that character is chosen, you know?
Is there not a screening process?
No, yeah, it's going back and bringing up aliens again and stuff. Like, we're pretty well aware why Ripley is on that mission, and she knows why she is too and stuff.
She kind of has to
for her own
sanity.
That's why she was put on the mission, you know, doesn't want to.
I actually liked how Cameron handled the info dump for the events of the first film on that the squad really didn't give a shit and they were making fun of her about it. I liked that because it subverted it, and then when Gorman's like, you know what, it's on disc, read it. You didn't need to explain it to the audience, even though the characters needed to know this backstory.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you've got a character that's receiving this information on the screen that doesn't know the stuff, then that scene can work. As with the Star Wars example, for instance, you've got Luke who sat there listening to Ben Kenobi tell him this stuff that he doesn't know. So mm-hmm. You're getting a two-way kind of thing. You get the audience is getting the information and the characters getting the information. It's only really, really, really tiresome when it becomes...
when both characters should know this.
When they know that stuff, because that's just so obvious, isn't it? It's just so kind of like, it's redundant. I can't look at it and go, why is that going on?
Well, one, I love 70s and 80s cop shows. And I have seen this plot done in almost every single one of them, from low-budget flash-in-the-pan shows to multi-season A-list shows. And that's the hard-boiled cop accidentally shoots a kid and then spirals into drunkenness and has to be pulled up once he hits rock bottom. God, do I hate that plot line. Why do you think that the writers on every freaking cop show ever made go to that plot? They've even done that in the comics. Alan Moore wrote a Green Arrow story where Green Arrow accidentally shot a kid and he spiraled into drunkenness. Why do you think that is so ubiquitous with cops and or vigilantes that it has become such a cliche? Sarah?
Well, first I want to know if he shot the kid with an actual gun or with a gun made out of his own willpower, because then there's no excuse for that shit. You controlled that bullet, literally. But it makes for instant drama, which all of us love so much.
Drama.
Yes, it's like, oh no, I must reexamine my life.
Oh no, I shot an innocent kid, even though I was technically doing everything right and the kid was in the wrong spot and he was holding a piece of pipe that looked like a gun when I was looking for a guy with a gun. And, you know, by the book, you did
nothing. It was a dark room. He was behind me.
Yeah.
Did the kid that Green Arrow happened to shoot happened to be Roy Harper, and he happened to shot him with heroin?
No. In the Green Arrow one, it was one of those. Green Arrow was being taunted by some supervillain, and this kid was in the alley. He turned around. The kid was there, and he just shot out of instinct and shot the kid through the chest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that happens all the time, especially, like, how that's I can't, like, think of a specific story, but, like Batman. You know, that's probably happened so many times to Batman. I'm more than sure I've read multiple comics that have had that. Superman, you know, any superhero, basically. It's such an easy trope to do. And, like, and they introduce them into the movies now and stuff. And it's an easy trope to do, especially with, you know, it's kind of the whole, like, with great power comes great responsibility. But then you have that downfall because, oh, no, that I broke that responsibility and I was supposed to protect these people. And now I'm a monster because I messed up. And it's like it's so overdone and tired. And yeah, especially with, like, the whole cop drama ones and stuff. It's, you know, cop dramas and superheroes, I think.
Yeah. It's a very familiar sort of thing, though, isn't it? It's something that people can kind of identify, that the hero has to face up to the consequences of what they do and what the consequences of what they do can actually lead to. So, yeah, it's tired, but it's something that people can kind of identify and relate to some extent. Yeah. It swings and roundabouts. Yes, it's overused, but it's kind of it's a useful counterpoint to having the hero who's infallible, and it sort of makes them face up to, you know, the potential for what they do.
Well, okay, then how about sticking with cop shows? How about, and I think they do subvert this quite well on some cop shows, but on any kind of drama, really, you've got a character that's leaving, whether it's announced or supposed to be a surprise to the audience. There's usually a buildup. There's foreshadowing. This character's life starts falling apart, or he's, you know, in debt to the mob or something like that. How about when they subvert this with something like on Hill Street Blues, when Santini got killed, or when Harris got and Santini got killed?
Spoilers. So
it happens early in the series. Harris is played by Mark Metcalf, the "What do you want to do with your life" guy from the Twisted Sister videos, and his character's kind of a jerk. They're just patting down some prostitutes. There's no build up whatsoever. Harris grabs one of their tits and then looks at Santini and kind of gives a smile. She pulls out a straight razor and cuts his throat, and you go, "Holy shit! I didn't see that coming, and there was no build up." And then you've got, like, John Kelly, David Caruso, leaving NYPD Blue, where maybe the last 10 episodes was all build up to, yeah, John Kelly is backed into a corner and you know his character is leaving. What way is better to do that? Which is more of the trope? The unexpected George R.R. Martin, "I killed the character because fuck you, that's why," or the long build up? Dustin?
Yeah, that depends, but I think the better, more smarter writer can get away with the "oh shit" kind of factor that surprises people, as long as they have some slight hints and it's not just like, you know, something's coming, oh, they're gonna die, and like building it up too much it can ruin it, and it can completely kill the vibe, because you're just like, okay, you're gonna get to a point where, like, get over with it, get it over with, just do it, okay. But then also, if you have it where it's just like boom out of nowhere, it can really piss people off, as in just like,
but like in my example of the Hill Street Blues Harris Santini thing, these guys are cops in the worst part of the city where their lives are on the line, and you know, one wrong move can result in their deaths.
But is that
arguably more realistic?
Realistic, but what you exactly said, they're cops in a bad part of town, and at any moment anything like that can happen, and it does happen. So there is a bit of a setup. If they're, say, at like a police station and that happens, you know, they just come in to work and
Matt Cordell walks in and guns them all down.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if it's something like that where it's just like, oh, well, average day heading into the office, you know, oh, what's on the report today? You know, what are they reporting out on the streets and everything? And then all of a sudden, like, the station blows up. It's like, what? You know, it's there has to be some sort of setup. And I feel if it's subtle enough like that, where, you know, it makes sense and it has that realistic take on it, where then that works because it's believable and you're going to be like, yeah, I can see that. Okay. But if, yeah, like, it's just like RoboCop, you know, they're chasing down these bad guys. They go into the factory after the bad guys. The bad guys have shotguns. They're going to blow them away, you know. Exactly. You know, no one's going to be like, that would have not happened. I did not see that coming. You know, it's like, you kind of had to.
Well, you kind of needed that for the plot to move forward too.
Exactly. But again, like if it was just that small story, like a small story like that about a cop, two cops who chase these robbers who are known robbers and that kind of stuff into their hideout
too.
Yeah.
It's known cop Boddicker killers. It was like the suspect in 15 police homicides. If you read the little file you see later.
Yeah, exactly. If you're like, and they set that up and everything, and you know that and stuff. It's just like, what do you expect? That's, you know, you're not going to be surprised that they kill this guy, that they kill this cop, you know?
Sarah?
Well, we might be very unfair to Glenn. They did cut a lot of the violence out of RoboCop, so maybe in his version he only got a scraped knee. But
fucking BBFC, right?
Totally. Yeah, I was going to go with the example for how not to do an extended death over multiple episodes by the one of the recent Doctor Who's, the one who was like, oh no, I don't want to go, and you're just like, fucking die already. Mm-hmm. But no, a worse one is on The Sopranos, when they actually had an actress die, and then they did that horrible like Photoshop of her in a chair as he's talking to her, and you're like, one, I know this actress is dead. Two, that looks like a horror from beyond the grave. Don't do this.
Yeah, the CGI wasn't quite at the point when that was made to make that look good.
No,
now you could probably do that. Then, no.
Yeah, it's eating your soul and such. I mean, if I'm going to go either way, I guess an example of doing it not so well in one episode, but nobody cared because nobody liked the character, was Seven. You know, he went upstairs and he never came back down and nobody missed him at all. But I would rather have it just, as you said, you know, hinted a couple episodes before, because you're being paid to write, that would be nice. But, you know, just do it. Just have a setup within the episode and kill them. Because people die and people can relate to that. We are not all 5-year-olds. You don't have to hold our hand for such things. It'll actually make the story better.
Glenn?
Well, I'm not really able to commit one way or the other on that, whether it's a long drawn out death or if it's a sudden thing. It's dependent on the dramatic situation. The only thing that really does bother me particularly is when they do that to a character and it's never referred to again, or the character just essentially is just disappeared. Oh, that person's gone. All right, okay, let's get on with our lives.
But
that gets a little bit tricky.
On that note, you also have being in the opening credits protection. Mm-hmm. That, mm-hmm. you know, this, like on Star Trek, Paris, yeah, is in deathly danger. Oh my God, we can't save him. He's got radiation sickness. He's going to die. No, he's not. He's a main character. He's not going to die.
That's the thing with Jennifer Leon when she left. That last episode had her.
Or some shit?
she kind of, yeah, sort of. It was a little bit ethereal, wasn't it? But her last credit was in the opening titles, but it was as a guest star.
That's the other thing. When they try to trick you, usually this happens with pilots, where they'll have a big name guest star in the pilot that they're building up to be a main character, and then they get killed in the middle of the pilot, and you go, well, duh. Did you really think Robert Patrick was going to stick around for Stargate Atlantis? He was a special guest star. Of course he's going to get killed in the pilot. You know, and so, sometimes the credits can betray that. Sometimes the credits, like when you see a big actor that maybe they've been on the last five episodes as a guest star, then they're on the next episode as a special guest star, you go, they're dead. As soon as they're special guest star, they're dead.
And isn't that the annoying thing when you get the big names as a guest star, and you know they're not going to be there for very long, but they make such a massive, massive big deal about them, and I always get very distracted by that. And I'm actually kind of glad when they're gone, to be quite honest, because these people who are very recognizable, they haven't had time to get into character, particularly not in the heads of the audience. And suddenly, you've got Bruce Willis in this series. I don't see the character. I see Bruce Willis. And then, you know, thankfully, they get rid of him, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Well, then on that note, you also have sometimes the stunt casting where this big name is brought in just to have a big name brought in. Like I like when a certain shows would have a big name guest star, except they wouldn't promote it. Just all of a sudden you go, is that William Shatner playing the lawyer? And you go, holy shit, that's Shatner in an uncredited role. I like that kind of thing where they don't promote it. They don't go, oh my God, you need to see this. This is this actor being in this. And you go, sometimes it's just fun. They do it sometimes as a favor to the person or not. You know, or sometimes to go back to what Sarah said about the horrible Photoshop CGI thing on The Sopranos, how about when they reboot a series and they try to make a callback to the original via CGI.
Oh, like, God.
Like The Night Stalker, the 2004 series, which, by the way, was a pretty good series. First three episodes are fucking terrible, but after that, there wasn't a dud among them. But in the pilot, they have Darren McGavin as Carl Kolchak CGI'd into the background of one of the scenes of the newsroom. Is that insulting or actual there for the fans?
I thought it was distracting as hell. It just looked like someone posted a bit of different film into the same scene.
Fair enough. Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing. It kind of reminds me an awful lot of the DS9 episode where they went back to the original Star Trek. Do you remember that one? Trouble with the Tribbles?
Trials and Tribulations. I loved that episode, honestly.
Which is, yeah, it to some extent it is a little bit fan service-y, and yeah, the technology isn't necessarily always quite there, but that's actually improving a hell of a lot. I don't mind it if it's not done as purely fan service. I think if it if actually got a story there that they want to tell, that's the primary thing. And particularly with that one, there was, you know, a bit of a story going on with it, and it was a nice nod to the classic series. So
I think my favorite part in that is a subtle little thing. Remember back in Trouble with Tribbles, there's just random tribbles still falling on Kirk's head after he opens the grain bin.
Yeah, yeah.
In Trials and Tribulations, it's Sisko throwing tribbles on Kirk. I just love that.
That was a very fun moment. Yeah.
It was a little subtle moment that I liked.
Yeah.
What about you, Justin?
Well, yeah, like you brought up, it's just like I feel that's better when it's just like subtle things, and it's like there to notice if, you know, it's just there for you to notice if you do notice it. And if it's not distracting, then yeah, fine. But if it's, you know, like a sledgehammer to the face, you know, it can be really, really distracting. And yeah, you know, it's fine to have like references to past stuff or other things. You tie in like series or movies and that kind of stuff, be it like characters or objects or anything like that. But it's when it's so blatantly just like, look at it. And can you believe it?
Are you kind of thinking of like when Ed O'Neill guest starred on Eight Simple Rules for Dating Your Teenage Daughter?
Yes.
Or even obvious, hey, look, Al and Peggy Bundy are back together again. No, they're not. I think sometimes that can work. For instance, I said they missed a great opportunity on My Name is Earl. Since Earl's dad is played by Beau Bridges, Jeff Bridges has a crazy uncle. I would have loved that. Or even better on Burn Notice. This one's a little deeper into nerd culture. Sharon Gless played Jeffrey Donovan's mom. So how about an episode where Meg Foster steals Sharon Gless's identity? You guys even get that one?
I can pretend I do.
The first six episodes of Cagney and Lacey, Christine Cagney was played by Meg Foster. They thought she was too dykey, so then she was fired, and then Sharon Gless took over the role for the following six seasons. So most people know Sharon Gless as Christine Cagney, and they forget Meg Foster played her for six episodes. Or am I getting way too deep into nerd background shit?
No, that would have been fun. No, that one that was done well, and I'll say, is the people who worked on Supernatural before they worked on that, they worked on X-Files. In the very first episode, it's just such a small aside that you could miss it. They walk by some FBI guys and they go, Mulder, Scully. That it's so simple. You don't have to make a big damn deal of it.
Okay, how about this one? When Ron Perlman was still on Sons of Anarchy, I said they should bring Linda Hamilton on as an ex-girlfriend who mentions how much more attractive he is now. What do you think? What do you think, Glenn? Are nerd references like that, do they get distracting, or if they're done subtle enough? And I'm talking like the stunt casting kind of nerd stuff.
I think it's fine. As long as it doesn't interfere with what's sort of happening in the program itself, you know, so it's not alienating those who don't know what's going on with those jokes. That's brilliant, you know, because you've got these things going on now. Some parts of the audience will understand it and get it. That's fantastic. But it's just when it intrudes upon the experience of the people who don't get it, that's when it's crossing the line, in my opinion.
Like, I heard a rumor that in Californication, they kept trying to get Gillian Anderson to do a cameo in Californication, and David Duchovny was like, no, we're not going down this road.
No fun.
You know what? I think they should have had an episode where he saw himself as a cross-dressing FBI agent and getting great. So how many people even remember he was on Twin Peaks, right?
I do.
Exactly. But how many people remember that was one of his first major roles?
Oh, Denise.
Yeah.
Yes.
Josh,
the strangest part of that was the episode where he had to go undercover on Twin Peaks as a male.
Mm-hmm.
He looked weird.
Yeah.
You know, he looked really weird. But so why do you think that these tropes are not attacked so much by the audience because they are so safe? Or do you think the audience is a lot like us where they're like, oh, fuck, I'm sick of seeing this done over and over? Because there's got to be a reason they keep going to them. The audience doesn't object as much as I think they should. Glenn?
But it's pretty much every trope is really just a shorthand anyway. So, I mean, people are not necessarily going to be looking at those things with the same level of detail as the likes of us here, for instance. And, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of comfort, I think, and security people get from the familiarity of various bits and pieces. So I don't think it's necessarily an absolutely egregious thing to use tropes, as long as you're smart and careful about how and what you use, and you're economic about how you use them. But it's like I say, it's kind of a shorthand, really. It's a way of communicating something quickly and easily, and in a way that people can immediately absorb.
What's up, kid?
Well, I'm gonna take it to with like the horror genre and that kind of stuff. You know, you look at what's popular and what's blowing up and that kind of stuff. You know, right now it seems to be, you know, James Wan kind of really tapped into the, you know, throwback to Poltergeist kind of ghost haunted house films and that kind of stuff. But yeah, and we seem to be getting a ton of those now where it's like family has ghost problems. What are they going to do? And then also we have the whole like found footage from like Paranormal Activity going on and stuff.
Anything Jason Blum touches is not worth seeing. I said it.
Okay, well, Josh being Josh. But you look at like even Friday the 13th and that kind of stuff. You know, when Friday the 13th, the first one came out and everything, the slasher genre blew up. And I'm going to plug myself right here. On Cadaver Cinema Radio, my cult movie podcast show that I do, when in our third episode, we were talking about The Brood. And my co-host brought up that, you know, before David Cronenberg's The Brood, there was like, say, maybe a couple body horror films, but then that one came out and it really hit big critically and became popular, and David Cronenberg became popular. And then you have this massive explosion of just like body horror films out there being made and stuff, and people trying to tap into that market. So I think with any sort of trope and everything, a big thing is trying to tap into the market from like the executives and producer standpoint and that kind of stuff. And even from like independent and that kind of stuff, you look at like the zombie films and that kind of stuff, independent films, they're really popular with going with the zombie genre because it's cheap and easy. You know, it's pretty easy to do a zombie film, you know, just slap some makeup on some friends and everything and have them walk around and go and stuff. It's you know, and that's just like a point of view from you know, like a horror movies and that kind of stuff. But these tropes that you're talking about, even like look at like buddy cop films and stuff, those exploded, those blew up and everything. You and then even with you know, Clint Eastwood with the Dirty Harry movies and stuff, you have that coming out, and then after that you have these gritty cops who, you know, they got to get taken off the case, but they're still trying to get the case done behind the scenes and stuff, and in the day they're the hero and stuff, but they're gruff and they're, you know, they're just like brick jawed grizzled like tough cops, you know, who, yeah, it's just tropes that worked at some point, and then they got turned into tropes because they're popular and worked, and people fed into them because they want to see more of that. So that's just my view on it and my kind of take on it. And yeah.
How about a feminine perspective?
Tropes are really easy to fall into if you're looking at your entire story in segments. If I'm writing the Josh Hadley sitcom and I go, we need a this episode, we need a that episode, these are, by the very way that I'm setting this up, going to become trope episodes. We're going to have the Josh finds a puppy on the road, Josh gets a traffic ticket,
evil
Josh
twin.
Wait, yes, evil twin who turns out to be the woman that he married in Vegas. Gosh, you have an interesting life. But but if you're writing this following the way that your characters are evolving, you might have a trope episode, but you have enough built up into this story that you're not going to suck at it. So all I'm saying is you can have tropes appear. There are some that are going to naturally appear. That's the thing about cliche. It does occur in life, so it might occur in your script. But have more faith in your story, people. That's all I ask.
Well, now, it would not be a trope for me to ask Glenn where people could find him if they choose.
Yeah, you can find me at Geek Juice Media and on YouTube as LampyMan101.
Now, it would be a trope for me to ask the kid.
Well, I'm also on Geek Juice Media. I have some old content on there that you can check out, some video game stuff. I'm not really doing that right now. I'm sort of done with that. I've moved on to my podcast that I'm currently doing right now, Cadaver Cinema Radio, which you can listen to on there. It's also on Podomatic. We're on Facebook at we have a Facebook group and a Facebook page that you can like. You can follow us on Twitter at Cadaver Cinema. You can follow me on Twitter at Grandpa's Kisses. Don't ask.
Okay, that's just creepy.
That's the point. But yeah, you can check that out. We're on Podomatic also. Hopefully we're going to have the show on iTunes soon. I edited it. And we have it on SoundCloud. We're hoping to get more episodes on there. We have more episodes on the way. And yeah, check that out. And other than that, I don't really got much other than this, you know, Lost in Static and that show. So that's what's going on with me and where you can find me and stuff that I do. So
no one cared anyway.
So yeah, exactly.
Find you.
You'll find some four-panel, two-dimensional adventures on 1201 on Josh's site. And 1201.com. Yes, 1201.com. And you'll find more stuff, which we'll add more to, at animakian.deviantart.com. And yeah, that's where I am.
And then you can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com or go to 1201beyond.com. And remember, go to adamandeve.com and get your 10 free gifts, man.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.